When President Bush was making his case for invading Iraq, there was one overriding aim: to stop terrorists getting weapons of mass destruction from Saddam Hussein.
The danger is clear. Using chemical, biological, or one day nuclear weapons obtained with the help of Iraq, the terrorists could fulfill their stated ambitions and kill thousands or hundreds of thousands of innocent people in our country or any other.
This danger of states with weapons of mass destruction and terrorists getting their hands on them is a real one. But while Iraq was an unlikely threat on both counts, the real threat was ignored. Pakistan already has a nuclear bomb, and as we'll reveal, Saudi Arabia was largely responsible for financing it.
They needed assistance, and they got some of the assistance from the Saudis. Now the question is, what was the motivation of the Saudis in providing such assistance?
Tonight we investigate the sinister connections behind Pakistan's nuclear black market, the nuclear ambitions of Saudi Arabia, and their links to terrorists.
Where you have Saudi interests and Pakistani interests and Al-Qaeda interests converging, it's a very frightening picture.
By failing to act on clear evidence of nuclear proliferation in the Islamic world, has the United States facilitated the real nightmare scenario?
We're now talking about nuclear weapons falling into the hands of terrorists. And it's very hard to imagine a greater nightmare than that.
Pakistan's nuclear proliferation was finally revealed earlier this year. It stands accused of establishing a virtual pan-Islamic nuclear supermarket. But in a remarkable feat of blame shifting, Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf has managed to deflect any punishment for what is clearly a shocking development in heightening nuclear tensions.
Thank you for so much for coming, Lauren. I'm honored that you and Mrs. Musharraf are joining us here at Camp David.
Content with looking the other way while Pakistan helps them in the war on terror, the United States has rewarded Musharraf with even more money and military hardware. Before the nuclear proliferation scandal stole the headlines, monuments to Pakistan's atomic might were scattered throughout the capital, Islamabad. Now only this one, a replica of the mountain where the country detonated its first nuclear device, remains intact. It's all part of a drive by President Musharraf to sweep the whole proliferation affair under the carpet. But despite his best efforts to conceal the truth, efforts condoned by the US government, intriguing new details about this dangerous black market in nuclear technology are coming to the surface. This is the man blamed for letting Pakistan's nuclear cat out of the bag. In Pakistan, Abdul Qadir Khan was not just any national hero. He was an icon, a living treasure. True, without him, Pakistan would never have been able to build the bomb. But is he the Dr. Strangelove character that the authorities suggest he is? A rogue scientist heading his own private underground network, trading in nuclear technology around the world. Certainly the Pakistani military want the world to believe that Dr. Khan acted alone.
It's just unfortunate that he, despite having done such a splendid and wonderful job for the country, he indulged into something which has brought a bad name to the country as well. And he has acknowledged that yes, he indulged into that activity, and he has felt sorry for that publicly, and that is on based on that the president has pardoned him. I would say that since he had a kind of autonomy, that is how in between him and his work there was no military involvement.
We are not going to tolerate the humiliation of our heroes at any cost.
Why?
Hassam al-Haq and his nieces have felt the pain of the nuclear scandal more than most. Hassam's brother, Major Islam al-Haq, was assigned to Dr. Khan by the military. But unlike Khan, who was pardoned, Major al-Haq languishes in jail on unspecified charges, along with four other colleagues.
Everybody was unaware that where they are being kept. Nobody knew where they are being kept, and they were kept in a very precarious conditions, in a very inhuman conditions, environment. Most of them, they complained that they have not seen the sunlight. They have not been able to see a sunlight, and they were kept in solitary confinement.
As Major al-Haq's four daughters grow increasingly desperate for news about their father, Hassam has launched a campaign for his and the others' release from prison. He believes the arrested men are simply scapegoats for Pakistan's military chiefs.
The responsibility should not have been taken by Qadir Khan. It should have been the generals, because nothing can happen without these generals.
Amongst the evidence of military involvement in the Khan network, secret photographs obtained of Pakistani C-130 aircraft parked on a North Korean airstrip. US military intelligence sources believe that they were used to transfer uranium enrichment technology to Pyongyang in return for missiles. The military confirm they bought the missiles, but say there was no technology swap.
How is it possible that Dr. Khan could fly in a C-130 aircraft, utilize the services of a C-130 aircraft without military knowledge?
I think most of these are just fiction stories made by the media. C-130 aircraft was used once, certainly, but that was used for getting the surface-to-air missiles from Korea. So that is it. I don't think these are unnecessary linkages being established by the media that, okay, since C-130 went, so something else would have gone into that.
But few people have accepted the Pakistan military denials. On Capitol Hill, a recent congressional panel blasted the White House for failing to act on Pakistan's nuclear proliferation.
Isn't this why we went to war in Iraq? But nary a word of condemnation has passed our collective lips when it comes to Pakistan's nuclear proliferation activities. And instead of getting to the bottom of AQ Khan's nefarious enterprise, the president proposes to make it easier for Pakistan to acquire sensitive U.S. technology. Hasn't Pakistan already demonstrated that they can't control their own technology, let alone ours?
But the Bush administration continues to hold its line.
If we had information about complicity of top levels of the government of Pakistan, we would act on it. At this point, there's no such information.
To some seasoned observers, especially those with ties to intelligence communities, America's handling of the Khan nuclear scandal is fraught with risk.
If a city disappears off the face of the earth, instead of just two towers collapsing, it may have its roots in these activities.
Joe Trento is an award-winning Washington-based investigative journalist with high-level contacts within the French intelligence service. They told him that the Americans were deliberately ignoring evidence of alarming nuclear proliferation in the Islamic world.
It was certainly apparent to French intelligence. They were convinced that the United States was deliberately not acting on any of this, and the British as well. Virtually everybody in Western intelligence knew about what Khan was doing and how he was doing it. So the real question became, why was he allowed to continue to do it? In other words, why was he allowed to spread the technology?
Trento's sources in French intelligence also suggest that there were other foreign forces at work behind the scenes of the Khan network.
The idea that he operated this whole network by himself is ludicrous on its face. Then what we're finding are ties back to some Saudi companies and Saudi's banking institutions and other things that are very disturbing. So the real question here is whether or not this is a much bigger thing than we thought, and whether or not Pakistan just simply was a stalking horse so Riyadh could have a nuclear weapon.
The first allegations that Saudi Arabia was seeking nuclear weapons appeared in 1981. Since then, many observers believe that the Saudis have satisfied their thirst for nuclear protection through their relationship with Pakistan.
The Pakistani-Saudi relationship may be denied, but frankly, it is very concrete and very real and goes back a long way in history.
This is what I consider a battle honour of my writing on Pakistan over the years. It was given to me by Khan because he thought I was an honest and objective reporter for the Financial Times.
Simon Henderson met Dr. Khan when he was working in Pakistan as a correspondent. He has also travelled to and written extensively about Saudi Arabia.
I think now is when Saudi Arabia is looking to Pakistan and say, we're interested in your nuclear arsenal and to provide some sort of nuclear umbrella for us as well.
While Saudi Arabia's nuclear agenda may have been common knowledge for years, it seems that the United States has been reluctant to get involved, even when it's handed what seems like hard evidence of the Saudis' ambitions.
Shame on our intelligence services for playing politics and business as usual when I had a defector sitting in my office with information.
Everything else okay, Dave? Have you been able to discern anything with the documents that you saw at all?
Manhattan immigration lawyer Michael Wiles has carved a niche in representing high-value intelligence defectors to the United States. One of them, Muhammad al-Khalawi, was a first secretary to the Saudi mission at the United Nations. He was a specialist in nuclear non-proliferation. In the weeks before his defection in May 1994, al-Khalawi began copying thousands of top-secret intelligence dossiers to take with him.
And he had access to the documents and literally spent days going to Kinko's across the street and copied about 14,000 documents and then came out and said, I had enough. I'm fed up. This is not what we should be doing as brothers and as a nation and as a world. And he got fed up on principle.
Armed with the documents, al-Khalawi attempted to set up a meeting with the FBI. It was a dangerous time. According to Michael Wiles, the Saudis were already looking for the defector.
Well, my client had a hit team dispatched to kill him. And the FBI calls me one Friday afternoon to tell me that they're en route. I said, well, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to protect him? How are you going to protect me? Well, we have an obligation to tell you that this information is credible, but we don't have the obligation to protect him.
The documents al-Khalawi had in his possession were simply staggering. Information on assassination plots against Western ambassadors in the US and covert Saudi intelligence operations on American soil. Also amongst them, evidence of Saudi Arabia's efforts towards nuclear proliferation.
Diplomats, according to Mr. al-Khalawi, were trained not only in intelligence operations, but how to take bomb-making material through border posts and diplomatic pouches. He showed me actually a diagram, which I can provide you if you like, of an individual, how you can sneak in bomb-making material through diplomatic posts.
But incredibly, the FBI agents who debriefed the Saudi diplomat were instructed not to accept any of the documents he was offering, presumably to avoid any embarrassment to the US-Saudi relationship.
Astoundingly, in a hotel around the corner from our office, the FBI left the documents that we produced that night after making a telephone call. The agents were being given different directions from their superiors in Washington. It was important to them that they come to the meeting, but more important that they leave without the documents, and I was shocked.
Even the Saudi ambassador to the US, Prince Bandar, wanted the affair dealt with quickly and quietly.
We were told repeatedly by the Saudi ambassador, let's work this out as gentlemen. If your client wants to get a green card, I can get it for him. No problem. I couldn't get the FBI to take a piece of paper off the table and give me a straight report without 12 people being consulted. But the Saudi ambassador could get him an American green card. Go figure.
In 1994, London's Sunday Times published details from Al-Khalawi's documents showing how during the 1980s, Saudi Arabia spent billions on Iraq's efforts to build a nuclear bomb on the condition that the technology be transferred to the kingdom if it was successful.
There was never any Saudi pursuit of nuclear weapons.
The author of many of Al-Khalawi's documents, the former head of Saudi intelligence, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, rejects their existence. He says Al-Khalawi was fired for incompetence.
I must set the record straight. He did not defect. He was fired by the Saudi consulate, I believe, or mission to the United Nations in New York. And when he was fired, then he decided to defect, claiming that he had all sorts of files and authoritative documents showing that Saudi Arabia was actively pursuing a nuclear weapons policy. He never showed those files. They were never published because they don't exist.
Dateline has since seen some of the documents copied by Al-Khalawi, which had been translated, certified and stamped by the FBI. Although Al-Khalawi remains in hiding, Michael Wilde says the FBI still consult him for advice in relation to Saudi terrorist links.
The documents that my client provided were vetted through not only by law enforcement, but several intelligence services, who not only have taken counsel with my client after every attack upon our interests internationally, but have also had FBI translators review the documents to test its veracity, and have done whatever measures they needed to check it. Nothing has been challenged.
As Saudi Arabia's spymaster for over 20 years, Prince Turki Al-Faisal probably knows much more than he's prepared to talk about on the record. He resigned as head of Saudi intelligence just days after the September 11th attacks. He's also named in a lawsuit brought by victims of the 9/11 attack over his alleged past links to Osama bin Laden. He's now the Saudi Arabian ambassador to Great Britain. He insists the Saudi kingdom has never pursued a nuclear agenda.
Well, Saudi Arabian money has been actually used for the development of the Pakistan.
Of course not. That is absolutely not true. It stands to contradict what I was just telling you. We would not give any money to anybody developing nuclear weapons.
I don't find that to be a credible position at all. They've had it, they've bought it, they've fought for it, they've tried to sell it into other nations. It was important to the Saudis not only to have this kind of protection for themselves, but to be able to market it, to continue to create that confusion in the region so that they could profit while everybody else was chasing everyone else.
The Saudis opened their first nuclear research center in an isolated stretch of desert in 1975. All they needed now was a bomb.
The Saudis helped to bankroll the Pakistani program, and so there has to be a quid pro quo in there somewhere.
Non-proliferation expert Leonard Weiss has followed Pakistan and Saudi Arabia's relationship closely for many years. He says the Saudis helped pay for Pakistani nuclear weapons so that they would come under the protection of their nuclear umbrella.
There has been some speculation in the past about the possibility of Pakistan stationing weapons in Saudi Arabia or possibly using weapons in protection of the Saudi royal family.
Weiss was one of the authors of America's 1978 Non-Proliferation Act, under the guardianship of Senator John Glenn. He says even back then, anti-proliferation efforts were often stymied. Now, Weiss believes that America's failure to deal with it properly may have a terrible price.
You should never lose sight of what the consequences are of making non-proliferation a lower objective in your foreign policy. And especially when we look at what the world situation is like today, where terrorism is playing such a high role, one can see that the failure to have dealt with non-proliferation problems in the past is now coming back to haunt us, and particularly with respect to Pakistan.